It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
And welcome to Let's Talk Legal here on the Talk Station, FM 107 at AM 1240 with Cecil Harvell, and joining this morning, Brian Schaefer. Good morning, folks.
Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Ben.
Good to have you with us. If you have questions that you would like to ask, our local numbers are 247-7282 or 353-4674. What are we talking about, Cecil?
Well, Ben, first of all, it is a pleasure to have Brian Schaefer here, one of the associate lawyers at the law firm here today with me. Wes is back in that jury trial again.
Still in trial.
So it's a laborious thing. A jury trial sometimes takes a long, long time, and this one certainly is. But he'll be back, let's hope, next week. But this week I have Brian here. Brian assists in the office primarily in the area of estate administration. And of course, Ben, the last 3 weeks, you and I have discussed estate administration and what it is and kind of what it isn't. There's a lot of fear about that famous word probate and everybody wanting to avoid it. And of course, we've talked about, you know, you can't be but so general with that word, because sometimes actually it is to the advantage of the family that some there be the structure of the law relative to probate. And it is not a costly and lengthy proceeding in the state of North Carolina. So these are some of the things that we've talked about, and today we are going to talk about, kind of from Brian's perspective, right, Brian?
Yes.
We're going to talk about some of the things that you see in the trenches, you know, some of the things that we can avoid. And let's begin with the one concerning our executor, Brian.
Sure. So one decision that you face when making your will is who will be the executor, and the executor is of course a crucial position. It's somebody who kind of works with the attorney when the time comes to administer the estate and do everything that needs to be done, and. The point that I wanted to make about that from my experience is just that a good executor is someone who has traits like being conscientious, being well-organized, being dedicated, being communicative with the attorney. It doesn't necessarily have to be somebody who is a financial genius, who has extensive background in finance or something like that. You can be a perfectly good executor without having very much technical knowledge. It's really a matter of commitment.
And it doesn't have to be automatically the next of kin, which is often the...
That's right, and it also doesn't even have to be somebody who's in the state of North Carolina. Sometimes we have a situation in which people, you know, might be choosing between, hey, I know, you know, I have one son who's in North Carolina and a daughter who's out in California, and I really think that my daughter is the more responsible one. Well, choose the daughter. That's fine.
The other thing concerning this, Ben, is just, you know, it's rare, but every now and then we will have an executor that comes in, takes the oath, gets appointed as executor, and then just seems to kind of disappear on us, you know, notwithstanding cell phones and emails. You know, we're not as responsive, and this can be frustrating, but again, that's rare. We tell clients if they have a friend, neighbor, loved one, brother, sister that will be responsive, then that's really all we need.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a relative.
No, right. It doesn't have to be. Now, a lot of folks, another tip that we talk about is appointing co-executors. And Brian has an interesting perspective on this.
Well, it's just to be a little bit cautious about appointing co-executors. Co-executors, of course, meaning that you're contemplating having the executor be more than one person, usually two people if it's co-executors. And I think that the thinking along those lines is often that somehow more heads are better than one, that somehow There will be a check and balance system between the co-executors or something
or
like that.
Or I can't decide.
Right.
It's really right. where it comes down to often.
Well, that it often ends up being the case of kind of too many cooks. You know, my point is just that be a little bit wary of that, because to the extent that we have co-executors work out well, and it sometimes does, usually it's really just one of them who is predominantly taking the lead in the process. And so really effectively, it's more like one executor really doing the work. So
but you can name an alternate executor, right? That, in case one couldn't. Yeah.
That's a good point, Ben, and that's really kind of a different matter. And you should name an alternate executor so that if your executor is predeceases you or is somehow unable or unwilling to perform their task, then there's an alternate.
Yeah, and because in this, well, the estate administration can last a while, so you could have something happen to an executor during
that's
that
time. Correct. That's correct. I think what, and I know that you know this, Ben, what we're talking about here is, you know, if you appoint co's, then they both have to sign everything. They both have to take the oath of office. They both have to sign the 90-day inventory, the final accounting, the tax return. And if they're in different states or different places, it's just coordinating two people.
Yes.
We see a lot of that. We work through it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's probably a good reason, a good thing for a family to need a good reason to appoint two.
Right.
Not just because we don't want to offend someone. Mm-hmm. I mean, what it needs to be said at this point, Ben, is that the executor doesn't hold any particular power over the beneficiaries. I mean, you must follow the will.
Mm-hmm.
You must follow the law as the administrator. You cannot violate your fiduciary duty. And so the executor, the administrator of a state, is held to a standard. And the standard is that, you know, you're going to need to be very precise in what you do, and you are not going to be able to self-deal with the assets
exactly.
or in any other way.
Yeah. I mean, you have a responsibility, as you said. You take an oath.
Correct.
You have that responsibility there.
Now, another tip from the trenches is something that we just see so often about investment accounts or bank accounts that are titled with a joint owner. And many times they are with this feature of right of survivorship, right, Brian?
Yes. So, you know, the idea here is that, you know, Cecil was touching upon the issue of going through probate and the kind of pros and cons of that, and perhaps the myths about it to some mm-hmm. extent. And joint ownership on a bank account or investment account, so forth, is one way to avoid that asset being a probate asset, and to that extent it's probably a good thing. That is, you know, this is a situation in which more than one person is on the title,
right.
is on the account. And what happens is that with right of survivorship, which is the usual state of affairs that we see in these accounts, upon the death of one of those people, the account simply goes over right to the other mm-hmm. one, and there's not really any administrative-like duties to perform.
Yeah, I mean, well, with a spouse, you know, you see that as a very, you know, it's a good thing and something that is. That can be done very easily. But if it's just a remaining person and they name one of several children,
mm-hmm.
then that's where you run into some potential difficulties.
That could be a difficulty. It could unbalance the what's being passed on to mm-hmm. your children to some extent. It could cause some conflict. That is a place to kind of watch out for. Another issue is just that you should be cautious about who you have a joint account with, because they can make changes on that account.
They can drain it.
They can drain it. They can make changes without your approval.
Yeah,
and
right.
so you better be a little bit careful about who you have that with.
Exactly.
There's no question about that. And the cousin, the other side of the coin, closely connected to this, is another tip that we have, in terms of the infamous payable on death,
right,
transfer on death, POD as in Paul O. Death, and TOD as in Tommy O. Death.
Mm-hmm.
TOD and POD are account designations that you make. You know, I had a case just yesterday where, you know, a very large estate passed almost exclusively by TOD death, TOD and POD designations,
mm-hmm.
Ben. And the problem was is that there was nothing left in the estate to pay the expenses of administration, to pay the taxes, to even pay for the funeral. And so the children, of which there were many in this file, each of them needed to ante back, if you will,
right,
enough funds to settle the estate.
Yeah, they had to give back into the estate.
Correct.
Yeah.
And, of course, all it takes is one of these children or one of their spouses, because at this point many of the times the folks are married, to object to that or to not understand that,
mm-hmm.
or for there to be a creditor out there like the Internal Revenue Service that comes first, or potentially even a child that is you know, receiving government benefits that has a claim of lien against anything that they inherit. I mean, again, you can begin to see that you have to be very cautious about these designations.
Mm-hmm.
I think when they are done with caution and done in a moderate way, then they can be useful.
Mm-hmm.
But to attempt to avoid probate,
right, again,
in its entirety, by using this method, is really not advisable.
You're creating a whole whirlwind of potential arguments.
You really are. And, of course, we need to take a break?
Yeah, we're taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment here with more with Harvell and Collins, Attorneys at Law, and Let's Talk Legal, and your questions will be welcome. Hey, welcome back to the program. Good to have you with us here this morning on Coastal Daybreak on the Talk Station. Every Tuesday morning, give you a chance to get your legal questions answered on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. And again, we're joined by Brian Schaefer and Cecil Harvell this morning.
So, Ben, we'll conclude on this particular issue concerning POD and TOD. But we all know that the reason that good folks designate their accounts in this way is that they're thinking that it's going to avoid cost. It's going to avoid delay. Things are going to go very easily and efficiently. Well, that's fine until you have an estate that doesn't have proper assets in it,
right,
to handle the estate administration, or the TOD and POD are done in such a way where one of the particular children or heir are not treated equally. And so off we go into, you know, where Mr. Collins is today in a jury trial.
Into trial.
And of course, you know, as we know, he's been there for over a week. So, you know, that's your worst case scenario, but it's certainly something that happens. All right. Moving forward, you know, I think that another important thing for us to talk about today is that if the decedent's estate is a modest one, then be prepared that the possibility exists that an attorney might be able to allow that estate to be insolvent. I know that sounds dramatic, but the bottom line is that, you know, we've talked about this before, Ben. The executor or the spouse or the heirs, they are not responsible for the debts of the decedent,
mm-hmm.
in terms of if the monies are not there.
Right.
They are to utilize the assets that are in the estate.
Mm-hmm.
And if the assets are not in the estate, then there's statutes in the state of North Carolina that dictate the preferences by which creditors are paid.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is something that a law firm can really get great result for a surviving spouse in many cases.
Right.
or even a parent for the children, if in order to structure the estate in such a way where it does in fact fall into an insolvent situation, and those credit card bills and bills at Best Buy or Lowe's or unsecured creditors that are out there, doctor bills, dental bills, you know, those things just don't get paid. And the creditors are aware of this. I mean, particularly credit card creditors, in terms of knowing that when there's a death, there's a change of circumstance.
It's one of the reasons interest rates are so high on credit cards. They make their money while they can. Okay.
Yeah, and it as a related point, you know, one thing that I just see day after day is that, you know, with these relatively modest estates, we have for all estates in settling them, we have this initial period of 90 days. That's the creditor's period. It's a statutory creditor's period. The creditors have that time to come forward and make a claim against the estate. And if it's one of these estates in which there's any question of solvency versus insolvency, then you know, one thing that the client should understand is that we shouldn't be paying any of the bills in those first 90 days.
Yeah, that's sometimes people, especially they're the executor, they don't quite understand their role. They want to jump right in immediately and start paying bills.
And from a good intention, I mean, they think, well, you know, bills should be paid, and this is a way of kind of honoring the decedent to go ahead and pay the bills. Well, in this case, actually, you should kind of just let it lie for 90 days and just see where we're at after the 90 days. It could be that it's an insolvent estate, in which case bills don't need to be paid. And the problem is, if you pay one bill without realizing this, you might be on the hook for a lot more than you think, because suddenly the other creditors have more standing to get paid.
So you pay them out of the order from their what the law, what statutory priorities are.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay, that's a good piece of information to know. Mm-hmm. And that 90 days, again, we were saying, Cecil, last week, I believe, at the end of that 90 days, you have a snapshot to take anyway, right, of where the estate is?
You do. And you really generally by that time, due to our best friend, the United States Mail, we've talked about that so many times on the program, that if the executor or the law office just receives the mail, we are able to, within 3 months, 4 months, really be able to get a good feel for what the assets are in the estate. And even more precisely, what the bills are, and then of course we either have a problem or we either don't have a problem in terms of, you know, we have enough assets to pay the bills. Some of the times we know this up front. We know this within, you know, for the first two or three conferences with the client. But again, this is a series of laws that we see over and over and over again, Ben, can create a very good result for spouses, surviving spouses, and even for the children of a decedent when we just pause and get our ducks in a row and don't pay creditors out of school.
Okay, we're going to take a short break and come back in just a moment. If you want to listen to past shows and find out more information online, including newsletters, you can go to harvellandcollins.com. That's harvellandcollins.com. And don't forget to call to make that first appointment, too, because a lot of these matters you need to take care of early, 252-726-9050. That's 252-726-9050, and we'll have more in just a moment. And welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, and Brian Schaefer in for Wes this morning, and Cecil Harvell with us as well as we round out our program this morning.
I'll let Brian conclude with yet one last tip that we are dealing with.
A touchy subject.
Yes, all the time. Yes.
Well, it's just to try to foresee any family tensions that might arise after your passing when you're thinking about doing these estate planning documents, such as your will, especially if you're in a situation that in which perhaps you're in your second marriage or some such situation that's a little bit out of the ordinary,
or if you just simply know that your children don't get along.
That's right, which is perhaps not very out of the ordinary.
Right.
But basically. You know, as we all know, I think, we do these legal documents partly to have a definitive statement of what we want to have happen when we die. So to that extent, these documents speak at your death.
Mm-hmm.
But the point here is that when they speak at your death, perhaps they don't, speak with all the context that you need.
Yes.
You would do well to not only have such documents, but also to talk through with your family members, while you can, your reasons for designing your documents in the way that you did, and explaining things to them, and trying to head off any sort of tensions that might arise that can be head off.
I think one way to put this also a little bit differently is we need to be realistic, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to make a family. We're not going to take away all of the conflict and make this family this harmonious Ozzie and Harriet family, you know, when we die through our will.
Right, right.
I mean, if there have been problems with one child that has needed funds over and over and over and over again.
Right.
Okay. And has been and therefore, you know, is treated and that therefore the people feel that they should treat the child differently because they've already received their inheritance.
Right.
These are the kinds of things that we're seeing, that if there's some way to work these things out ahead of time, it's very, very helpful, because we're not going to change those dynamics after a death through a last will and testament.
But as you said, and Brian, you were saying this, that you can really be very specific so that you can let the document speak. If you don't want to have that conversation with your kids and your family before you die, at least make the documents very specific.
Well, that's certainly true. It's just in the best of all worlds, Ben, I guess we really want both, don't we?
Yeah,
we want the documents to be very clear, but we also want everybody to have some idea, you know, if face to face with you before the documents become effective, before
mm-hmm.
you pass, in which they just kind of hear it from you that hey, this is why I did things the way that I did. This is especially true in situations such as a second marriage, in which obviously your current spouse would be very dear to you, and let's say you have children from your prior marriage, they're very dear to you, but maybe the
here's
second spouse,
here's why she's getting the house,
that's for example.
Right. You know,
sometimes that second spouse and those children may not have that much of a connection to one another.
Mm-hmm.
It may end up being somewhat antagonistic toward each other. We've seen it before. And that this sort of talking it out beforehand can be very helpful in that.
No mess like a family mess there, you know. So you have to, again, you can try to be as magnanimous as you can and talk it out ahead of time, but at least have the documents speak clearly.
Absolutely. And there's nothing better than dealing with it now. We don't have time, but I'm a proponent many times if a parent wants a particular property to go to a child,
mm-hmm.
maybe because they're handicapped, maybe because
sure.
they feel that they need that property, then, you know, hey, let's go ahead and get that done now in some sort of effective way so that the rest of the family can live with the fact that that's what the decision is.